The Galapagos seems a perennial source of new things, Darwin wrote to Hooker, after Hooker had sorted through Darwin's Galapagos plant specimens. And of course, it is not only the Galapagos that poses the mystery of mysteries. On almost any patch of Earth, the variety of animals and plants is staggering. Once, as a botanical demonstration, Darwin chose a small fallow field in Kent. It was a poor field without water, its soil of heavy, very bad clay, Darwin writes in Natural Selection. On this land, in the course of a year, a friend of his collected plants belonging to 108 genera. Darwin knew of another botanist, who says that he covered with his hat, I presume broad-brimmed, near to Land's End, six species of trifolium, a lotus, and anthillus, and had the brim been a little wider, it would have covered another lotus and genista, which would have made 10 species of leguminosae. Darwin himself went one better. One February, he relates in The Origin, he took 3 tablespoonfuls of mud from 3 different points beneath water on the edge of a little pond. This mud, when dry, weighed only 6¾ ounces. I kept it covered up in my study for 6 months, pulling up and counting each plant as it grew. The plants were of many kinds and were altogether 537 in number, and yet the viscid mud was all contained in a breakfast cup. All told, there are somewhere between 2 million and 30 million species of animals and plants alive on the planet today. Something like 1,000 times that many species, almost 2 billion by the most conservative guess, have evolved, struggled, flourished, and gone extinct since the first shelly fossils were laid down in the Cambrian explosion about 540 million years ago. And the great question for the evolutionist is, why? Darwin did not claim that natural selection is the exclusive agent in the origin of species, but he did maintain that his mechanism is one way of producing new species, and that it is probably the main way. He stakes this claim in the title of his most important book, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. In his first secret notebook, he sketched the origin of species as a few rough, diverging lines, calling the sketch at first the coral of life. One species splits into two, two into four, growing and radiating into branches that will fork again. Later, the image was elaborated by Darwin's followers, such as the German biologist and philosopher Ernst Haeckel, into great gnarled oaks with hundreds of species names neatly lettered at the twig tips. That is how David Lack drew his chart of the family tree of Darwin's finches. Lack's chart represents a close-up of one branch on the tree of life. The species the Grants have chosen for their life's work are half a dozen twigs on this branch. They are the 6 species that Lack placed in the center of his diagram, the ground finches. 3 diverging twigs on the left, 3 diverging twigs on the right. Darwin's finches, of course, are a classic model of adaptation. Generations of textbooks have used their celebrated toolkit of 13 beaks to illustrate the process. Darwin's finches are also a classic model of speciation. Again, they figure in virtually all of the textbooks, very often as the central illustration. That is why these birds have become such a universal symbol of Darwin's process. So that their beaks now represent evolution the way Newton's apple represents gravity, or the apple of Adam and Eve represents original sin. The standard textbook description of speciation sets the story in the dim past like a scientific book of Genesis. The textbook diagrams and charts suggest that the flora and fauna of the Galapagos Islands are endpoints, products of a process of creation that went on once, in the beginning, and is now more or less complete. But in Darwin's Islands, the forces of creation are still at work, in plain view, with the manufactory still in action. And since Darwin's mechanism for the refinement of a finch beak is also his mechanism for the manufacture of a new species, the Grants database allows them to test the power of both processes at once. They can analyze not only the forces that shape adaptations, but also, at the same time, the forces that put new beings on this earth. When Darwin thought about the way the branches of life can grow and split, his mental image was first and always what he imagined had happened in the Galapagos archipelago. Darwin assumed that the summits of these lonely volcanoes were settled by a few chance colonizers that blew or drifted out from the coast of South America. He reasoned that the first immigrants to thrive on the naked lava must have been plants, since any animals that arrived before the vegetation would not have lasted long. A seed-eating finch cannot last a day without seeds. Conventional wisdom said seeds would be killed by salt water. So Darwin at Downhouse tried soaking seeds from his garden, including lettuce, carrots, and celery, in little bottles of brine. Then he planted the seeds in glass dishes on the mantelpiece of his study, and was tickled to see them sprout even after 42 days in salt water. In 42 days, the average current in the Atlantic could have carried these seeds 1,400 miles. They could have lasted the length of an ocean voyage. That was the point of Darwin's pottering about with mud from the edge of a pond. Wading birds, which frequent the muddy edges of ponds, if suddenly flushed, would be most likely to have muddy feet. They could carry mud and seeds with it from one place to another. Darwin was not above gathering bird droppings and picking out undigested seeds with a tweezers. He planted these seeds and they germinated too. So the first birds to fly over an island could help make the islands fit homes for more birds. Sometimes his experiments misfired. Darwin complains in one letter that the fantails have picked the feathers out of the pouters in their journey home. The fish at the zoological gardens, after eating seeds, would spit them all out again. Seeds will sink in salt water. All nature is perverse and will not do as I wish it. But other days his unorthodox experiments left him cackling with glee. He fed oats to sparrows and fed the sparrows to an eagle and a snowy owl at the zoo. Then he waited around a few hours, collected their pellets and planted them. A seed came up. "The hawks have behaved like gentlemen," he wrote to Hooker. "Hurrah!" In the Galapagos, experiments like these are still going on all the time. The archipelago is so young that not even the beginning is over. The very colonization of the islands is in progress, and members of the Finch Unit can watch it unfold before their eyes. When they fly to the islands from the Ecuadorian city of Guayaquil, they look down from their plane windows at the great Guayas River. The Guayas debouches into the convergence of two major ocean currents, the South Equatorial and the Humboldt. Anything rafting down the river can get swept out to sea and westward to the Galapagos. From the plain, the Grants often see dozens of natural rafts on the river. The muddy water twists and turns, and long green strings and strands of matted greenery go drifting along with it. Anyone who takes off from or lands in Simón Bolívar International Airport in Guayaquil can look down at these fateful rafts. Green mats in the dark green delta, perpetually floating out to sea. In Darwin's view, this was the first step in the origin of Galapagos species, colonization, immigration. And the Grants can watch even this step in action. During their first years in the islands, they were surprised to discover half a dozen flame trees growing on the far northern island of Wolf. Flame trees are common on parts of Santa Cruz and on Santiago. But the Grants could not imagine at first how the tree's seeds had gotten all the way from these islands, which are in the center of the archipelago, to Wolf, at the farthest northern edge of the archipelago, where their red flowers look as striking and deliberately placed as a carnation in a black buttonhole. The Grants found another odd outlier, a single flame tree, old, solitary, and flamboyant, on the west side of Genovesa, about 400 meters from the sea, the only flame tree on the island. On Genovesa, red-footed boobies and frigate birds often pick up bits of brightly colored plastic from the beaches and drop them far inland or along the tops of cliffs. The Grants, walking along the steep cliff of Darwin Bay, above the landing called Prince Philip's Steps, have often found bottle caps, combs, streamers, and gaudy drift plastic of all kinds. The flame tree's seeds are as red as their flowers, and the Grants wondered if the birds might have picked one up from the beach and carried it inland. To test this idea, Peter, Rosemary, and their younger daughter, Thalia, put 30 flame tree seeds in a jar of salt water. It was the same sort of experiment that Darwin tried it down, only the Grants were carrying it out right in the Galapagos, in their camp on Genovesa. Whenever they were back in camp from finch watching, they stirred the water in the jar. After 3 days, most of the seeds were still afloat. Toward the end of the Great Niño, the Grants have reported, they found almost 100 of these seeds strewn on the southern beaches of Genovesa, where there is not a single flame tree. They found even more seeds of the poison apple, which does not grow anywhere on the island. Apparently, these seeds floated to Genovesa from another island, swept there by El Niño. Washed down to the sea, the Grants write, in the torrents and temporary rivers that flowed so often that year on Santa Cruz and Santiago. It is even possible they were carried all the way from the South American continent. On a typical voyage between islands, the Grants, sitting on a bench at the bow of their boat, may see a green sea turtle, a shark, frigate birds, dolphins, manta rays, whales, and other lively inter-island traffic, including rarities like the Hawaiian dark-rumped petrel, elegant white with black-rimmed wings, beautiful and endangered. Young and immature masked boobies will circle the boat, looking closely at the finch watchers each time they cross the bow and coming closer and closer with each pass to Peter's outstretched hand until he withdraws it, absent-mindedly, talking away. The boobies hover and stare at the humans on deck, the birds' brown heads and bodies as sleek as seals, seals with wings. Young boobies are such strong flyers, they do it so well, that they are a pleasure to watch, and they seem to take pleasure in their motion themselves. So there are endless streams of wanderers between the islands. When Trevor Price was standing watch on Daphne with his field assistant and childhood buddy, Spike Millington, they kept a bird list, just as they did when they were boys growing up outside London. They spotted 22 different species of vagrants on Daphne Major. One spring, they heard a Hawaiian petrel calling nightly for almost a week in March and for another week in April. Sometimes, just offshore, they saw white-vented storm petrels and an immature great blue heron. They also saw peregrine falcons, yellow legs, a ruddy turnstone, a willet, an offshore flock of about 2,000 northern phalaropes, several species of warblers and gulls, and a dark-billed cuckoo. Even among the finches on the island, the permanent residents, the citizens of Daphne Major, some are conspicuously more restless than others. In their camp at mealtimes, the finch watchers sometimes see what looks like a little bug, growing larger and larger, winging over the crater. It is a finch whose territory is on the other side of the volcano, but who has acquired a taste for exotic travel. Meal after meal, there he is again, a born tourist, hopping in the alleys between the chimbuzos, cadging another morsel. Darwin thought his finches were all more or less marooned, each on its own island. But these birds are still wandering and straying across their islands, all across the archipelago. The Rothschild expedition at the turn of the 20th century spotted a single specimen flying many kilometers out at sea. Price and Millington found a few tree finches that landed on Daphne but did not stay. They also found a few immigrant Fuliginosa, Fortis, Magnirostris, and Scandens. Every year, some of these species are spotted on the island, usually the ones they call immatures, the young and the restless. Sometimes, after a breeding season, 100 or more immatures will land on an island and visit a while. But invariably, Peter says, they all leave or die before the next breeding season. So every year, some of Darwin's finches go island hopping, landing in new places and new corners with new neighbors. During the Great Niño, quite a few finches from other islands visited Daphne Major, including some Magnirostris. The immigrants came in late 1982 and started breeding, says Peter. 5 or 6 decided to stay, and some of their offspring are still on the island. Dispersal is not unusual. Breeding is. The agitations of the Super Niño shoved these strange finches together, and at the same time, the hybrids began their rise.